Chapter 4. CIA People Policies. Responsibility for agency operations in Africa was centralized at the desk of the Africa Division Chief, Jim Potts. Potts made all decisions about field operations and personnel assignments. The 300 people serving in Africa Division were essentially his staff. He decided courses of action. They drafted the appropriate cables for his review before transmittal. In CIA operations, as in the State Department, the hand that signs the cables controls the action. Potts was especially determined to involve himself in every detail of the Angola program. Crippled, a prisoner of his affliction, he compensated in full measure by throwing himself into IA feature. If his body was immobilized behind his desk, his mind reached across oceans and continents. He read everything and seemed to remember it all. Potts and I were contrasting but compatible personalities. My job as task force commander was roughly equivalent to the work of GS-16 branch chiefs, although I would defer to their senior grades. Coming in cold from an overseas assignment, I did not have at tongue-tip the store of detailed knowledge I really needed for the job. That was okay with Potts. He didn't want competition in making decisions, and I had what he lacked, the physical mobility to range across the building, if necessary, across the world, to get things done. He was the 3-star general, I the colonel. He made decisions and gave orders, and I, like the chief of staff of an army division, supervised their execution. Potts's primary vehicle for communicating decisions was the 9 a.m. staff meeting, where he methodically interrogated every unit head and gave them marching orders for the day. To play the game, you read every cable that had come in from your area during the night, and were ready to answer any question Potts might think to ask. How much is IA Mogul 1's salary? How many intelligence reports did he provide last month? Okay, draft a cable approving the one-time payment of $750. A normal branch might have 10 cables each morning, 3 requiring careful study, most marked routine. My task force received 50 or more immediate cables daily. Routine business consumed 15 minutes. Potts then spent an hour on the Angola program, while the rest of his staff listened, and I concentrated taking notes. After staff meeting, Potts communicated through notes scrawled on little yellow buck slips. Known as Pottsgrams, they often carried important decisions as well as reminders and reprimands. Things like, let's get an airplane out with some additional 4.2 mortar ammunition. Or, please find out how much the Air Force wants for those 10 C-47s in Thailand. Potts, who had an aversion to bureaucratic structure, fired these notes at random throughout the division. The Lusaka section chief might be ordered to get out a plane load of ammunition. The Horn and Central deputy asked to draft a memorandum for Henry Kissinger. And a reports officer charged with researching the Israeli price for 120mm mortar ammunition. Quickly, I learned to make the rounds of all offices, collecting Pottsgrams and centralizing them at the task force. I didn't know Potts well. He had come into Africa Division in 1972, shortly before I went to Vietnam, as Deputy Division Chief under Larry Devlin. Footnote. Devlin was famous for running the Congo operation in early 1960, and for the Laos operation in the late 60s. End footnote. In 1974, Potts became the Division Chief. His prior experience had been in the Middle East, Athens, where he had recently been Chief of Station. As an honor student and football player at Yale, graduating in 1943, Potts was a solid member of the Eastern establishment, which dominated the CIA. I had heard other officers complain that he was frustrating to work with because he centralized too much control at his desk. It was said that his understanding of Africa was shallow, although he had memorized an impressive volume of facts and names. To keep up with the task force workload, I would need a staff of 24 people, including 4 case officers who could answer cables and write memos, other case officers to run agents and to gather intelligence about Angola, 2 paramilitary officers to plan the arms shipments and supervise the war, covert action specialists who would run the propaganda campaign, logistics and finance officers, reports officers to disseminate the intelligence, and secretaries and assistants. Word spread quickly through the building that the Angolan task force was hiring. The day after I came back from Texas, people began to seek me out. Young officers were looking for adventure and experience. Old officers hoped to work on one more operation, to hang on a while longer before retirement. After the collapse in Southeast Asia, almost 1,000 CIA employees had returned to headquarters. Colby had decreed that no one would be fired, not even the Vietnamese linguists who had been hired on 30-day contracts because their educational backgrounds fell short of CIA case officer requirements. Hundreds of people were looking for jobs. My Vietnam experience saved us from most of them. I knew too well the sloppy, low-pressure environment in which they had learned their intelligence skills. We needed speakers of Portuguese, not Vietnamese, and people who knew Africa. At the same time, there were only 12 genuine Portuguese linguists in the agency, and the good ones had secure jobs. The DDO had given us a license to Shanghai anyone we wanted from any office. We could have the best people in the operations directorate. However, having made that verbal gesture, Nelson was unwilling to back us up. No chiefs wanted to lose their best help, and we didn't have the clout to take them forcibly. Other chiefs had their own private uses for the task force, to provide for their own protégés. Rarely could I get the individual I wanted, and people were dumped on me who weren't much help. I wanted Nick Kohler to help get the task force started, then go to Lusaka and maintain contact with Savimbi in the Angola base camps. Nick was 27, fit, rugged, and had a military background. 2 combat tours as a special forces officer in Vietnam, a CIA tour in Vietnam, where he had worked 16 hours a day and stayed out of trouble. Savimbi should take to him. Nick was a rugby enthusiast, and Savimbi had played second row while a student in Portugal. Nick had finished his CIA Vietnam tour in November 1974. When I got back in May 1975, he had rushed up to me in the hall, his blue eyes snapping, his squared shoulders radiating physical power and drive. He was dressed in a sharp pink and gray suit with flared trousers and a hint of safari in the lapel and pockets, and 3-inch wooden-heeled shoes on which he stood almost to 6 feet, my height. I had smiled, remembering his personnel file, which I'd read in Saigon in July 1973 on my way up country. 6'1", the biographic sheet had said. And when I'd met him, I immediately registered the exaggeration. When I got to know him better, I realized he had doubtlessly seen to it that the file made him seem bigger than he was. In the same way, he bullshitted us about his investments. This thread of blarney in his character did not greatly offend me. It was a common enough trait among case officers. I had smiled again when I remembered our confrontation over his dress up country, when I had ordered him to stop wearing his bathing suit and shower shoes to the sweltering upcountry office. Now he looked like a page out of Esquire. In short order, he had told me that he was preparing for an assignment to Kinshasa, that he was juggling 2 girlfriends and playing around on the side, and that he had made first string on Washington's best rugby team. He had been practicing his chess and tennis, hoping to beat me, and was studying French full-time, determined to make a 3 by the end of the course. We went drinking that night in Georgetown. Potts wouldn't accept Nick Kohler, and he wouldn't tell me why. In frustration, I asked a branch chief, and he told me, "Potts thinks Nick is too young." The same day, I bumped into Sam Hilton in the hallway in front of Potts's office. Hilton had been a staff officer of the Saigon station. He was over 50 and genial, but lazy. You got your business done in his office before 5 o'clock, or not at all. He collared me as I hurried down the hall. Otherwise, I would have nodded and walked past him. "John, you're the head of the Angola task force, aren't you?" I nodded. "Well, it looks like we'll be working together. Jim Potts just asked me if I would postpone my retirement and go into Angola to work with one of those black clowns over there." Not the man for IA feature, Hilton was a dues paid in advance member of the agency's senior clique, a burned-out hero of previous wars. I tried to see Potts, then Carl. Neither was in. Finally, I found George Costello. He knew Sam Hilton. "George," I said, "Sam's not the man for the Lusaka job. He isn't fit enough, and he doesn't..." "Now, wait a minute, John. Slow down. Sam has done some things you couldn't even touch. He parachuted into Greece when there were Nazis all over the place and single-handedly tore them a new asshole. You young people don't know what danger really is." "How long ago was that, George?" "Well, let's see. It was 1943. 32 years ago. How old was Sam then? He was in his 20s. You should have seen him. He was strong as a mule. He isn't very tall, but he could have broken someone like you in half. Okay, I said, but all that was 30 years ago. I just saw him in the hall. He's fat and soft. And I knew him in Vietnam. He loafed, drank a lot, inhaled long black cigars. Costello looked at me with thunder in his eyes, but I held up my hand. George, I hope he got medals and a hearty thanks for what he did in Greece in 1943. But this is 1975, and we're talking about Angola. Sam is over the hill physically. So are you. Right now, Nick Kohler could whip all three of us at the same time. He's 27. It's his turn. You guys have to step aside and let Nick's generation have its chance. Some pop-off valve in his mind blew, and the red went out of his forehead. He was chuckling as I left his office and went to find Potts. But Potts didn't laugh. He stonily put me out of his office. The next day, I had lunch with Sam Hilton. We both took seconds of everything and then two desserts while I told him what he would find in Angola. I carefully dropped comments about Land Rovers, dust, hard beds, poor rations, and the absence of doctors, booze, and playful women. We shook hands in front of the credit union, and I went back to work. A few days later, I heard that Sam Hilton had retired and was on his way to Florida. After some delay, Nick Kohler went to Lusaka. Andy Anderson was also interested, and he would have been a good man for Angola, but he was black. His loyalty should have been far beyond question, since he had originally been recruited to survey and report on American black radicals as they traveled in North Africa, in one of the agency's most explosively sensitive and closely held operations against Americans. But Potts felt we had to be very careful about letting blacks into the program, because of the South African involvement. Most minority groups in the agency are subjected to subtle but firm discriminatory barriers. It could not be otherwise. The men who control the CIA are of an older, conservative generation, which has kept the agency 15 or 20 years behind the progress of the nation at large. The Equal Employment Opportunities Office and the other standard bureaucratic mechanisms for handling complaints are ineffective against the subtle barriers of discrimination. Blacks will rarely have a specific incident to complain about, but their fitness reports will say proficient and strong instead of strong and outstanding, and they have difficulty getting the good jobs until they inevitably plateau at the GS 12 or 13 levels. The personnel management committees are exclusively white, men of the agency's older generation, and they meet behind closed doors. In Vietnam, a competent GS 13 black officer volunteered to come up to my post when we were being shelled frequently, and two whites had broken under the strain. He, too, had a family and kids back in the States, but he ignored the danger and worked hard. When awards were given months later, he received a certificate of distinction, a piece of paper. The rest of us got medals. Second and third generation Orientals are acceptable. Several have made super grade. One young woman was suggested for the task force with a cryptic, "If you want her." I knew Laura Holiday. In 1972, she had collaborated well with me on a special project, a test of special agent communications equipment, wherein she had driven across the eastern United States alone, sending sample messages back to headquarters. But the cryptic, reserved recommendation stirred my curiosity. I took 5 minutes to glance at her file and read the last two fitness reports, and then I asked friends about her professional development. After our collaboration in 1972, Laura had been assigned overseas. Her chief of station was a rising young officer with a reputation for preferring operations that included available women. Before going to the post, he had persuaded the front office to give him the cover slot for a young woman officer, and he had scurried about interviewing the various candidates, settling on Laura Holiday. He miscalculated. For Laura, liberation meant the freedom to say no as well as yes. The COS was peevish. Their working relationship was affected, and he gave her a critical evaluation in her fitness report. There was nothing more to it. I accepted Laura on the task force, happy to have her. Another agency minority has it made. Second-generation officers, generally with the sponsorship of their high-ranking fathers, have been coming into the agency in increasing numbers. Eileen Ranklin was such a person. She was 24 and had already been on board for 3 years, although the normal age for hiring case officers is about 25. An exception had been made for her because she spoke good French, and also because her father was a GS-18 division chief. Another former division chief's daughter of the same age was already serving in West Africa as a case officer, undercover as a State Department stenographer. Eileen Ranklin and 4 other second-generation officers were considered for the task force. Ranklin turned us down, but 3 joined us. A 4th person, the young widow of an agency paramilitary officer, was also hired, as the agency family took care of its own. While the task force was shaping up, arms and supplies were, of course, flowing steadily to Angola. Early on in these logistical doings, I had a nasty surprise. The CIA did not have a competent office to plan and arrange arms shipments. The office existed on paper in the Special Operations Group, but it was not staffed with people truly qualified for the work. Its staff of retired Army, Air Force, and Navy personnel, plus a sprinkling of younger one-tour military officers, who were originally hired on contract by the agency for paramilitary assignments in Southeast Asia, was surprisingly inept at the hard, detailed planning required for a war effort. SOG sent us 2 men to plan the IA feature arms flights. 1, a Marine Corps major, who was doing a rotational tour of duty with CIA, helped us greatly until he was sent on another priority mission to Southeast Asia. The other, an old colleague of mine, Arnie Hall, had primary expertise as a lecturer about guerrilla patrolling. He had served 1 tour upcountry in Laos and a few months in Vietnam, where he had helped with the final evacuation, none of which qualified him for the job of planning our arms shipments. Arnie Hall was popular in SOG, the image of a paramilitary expert. 6 inches shorter than I, his shoulders sloped 3 inches on either side of mine, and dropped straight down to a barrel girth that bespoke of enormous physical power. A small round head sat neckless on square shoulders, cropped with hair that was never more than 1/4 inch long, and mounted with a tiny, expressionless face. I first met him in 1972 in the mid-career course at the farm. Footnote, Camp Perry, Virginia, the CIA training base. End footnote. When he often came to class playing his paramilitary role to the hilt, wearing combat boots and an 18-inch jungle knife which he would whet on a handstone during the lectures. We carpooled together, and I soon learned it was all a splendid put-on. He had, in fact, grown up in Philadelphia, and had never even served in the infantry. He had a humorously strange mind and spontaneously flipped out in-character one-liners. "Give me some C4 and I'll get that truck out of the way." Or, "Next time that long-winded bastard lectures us, I'm going to slip some copper sulfate in his drawers." At other times, he would come out with something like, "Nimium nigredi colori, there's pimples under that mascara," and walk away, leaving you wondering just what intellectual interests might be hiding behind that knuckle-dragger facade. After the Marine major left on his mission, Arnie worked as a team with an African Division logistics officer, Price and Pride, we call them, to plan the arms flights. Neither had ever been to Africa. Even so, Price and Pride eventually became quite good at tailoring loads of ammunition to fit the stream of C-141s we kept launching. There is something about an upcoming weekend that excites the decision-maker. Inevitably, it was late Friday before we made the decision to send another flight. Price and Pride paid the price, grousing and doodling with their notes and calculators until their figures were checked and double-checked, and the Office of Logistics could take over and deliver the required material to the Air Force. "Why don't we throw in some .45-caliber pistols?" one of them would quip. "They're worthless in combat, but we can get them cheap. And how about 1,000,000 rounds of .30-caliber ammunition? How much does it weigh? Somebody look up how much .30-caliber ammo weighs." Potts had even less knowledge of infantry weapons and ammunitions. His modus operandi consisted of a quick look at Jane's weapon systems and a lengthy argument about the advantages of one rocket over another. The results reflected our amateurism. We delivered into Angola 622 crew-served mortars, rockets, and machine guns, 4,210 anti-tank rockets, and 20,986 rifles. Footnote. In addition, the Chinese, South Africans, and Mobutu supplied several thousand rifles. Other countries contributed armor cars, anti-tank missiles, 120-millimeter mortar ammunition, cannon, and light tanks. End footnote. Even though UNITA and the FNLA combined never fielded more than 10,000 soldiers. Most of the rifles were obsolete World War II semi-automatics, no match for the AKs the MPLA was getting. All of these guns cost a lot of money. While we knew that the 40 Committee had authorized sufficient funds, it took us many months to obtain a full-time financial expert who could tell us just where our money was. Until then, whenever money problems arose, Potts would take out his pen and a scratch pad and begin adding and subtracting, recalling a figure from the week before, rummaging the papers on his desk to confirm a detail. If he wasn't there, Bantam or I or someone else would fill in. Theoretically, financial matters would be handled by the Africa Division finance officers in the support section, but they were overloaded with routine work and distracted with temporary duty missions. Whenever we pressed for better financial support, the chief of support would wave his hands expansively and say, "Don't worry about the money. You need some money? I'll find you some money," which didn't help us much in precise planning for an arms flight or budgeting for a mercenary program. Carl Bantam developed into our best amateur financial expert. When something had to be gotten out in a hurry, we would go to him. The price for this assistance was listening to his opinions of Africa Division's inability to handle things more professionally. Otherwise, Bantam was frustrated and out of step. With strong reservations about our intervention in Angola, he also disagreed with Jim Potts about how we should go about it. Uncomfortable in his role as deputy chief, he attempted to make decisions only to have Potts counterman them. He wrote cables which Potts rewrote as he would for a junior officer. In a truculent mood, Bantam set about to devise schemes which would short-circuit our program by quickly and efficiently winning the Angola War. One plan, which he outlined in a memo to the DDO, suggested that we introduce one of the flying gun platforms which had been so effective in breaking up massed communist attacks in Vietnam. These were C-47s, originally called Puff the Magic Dragon in Vietnam, rigged with a half a dozen Gatling guns programmed to aim and fire simultaneously, raining 8,000 rounds a minute into an area the size of a football field, driving a bullet into every 6 inches of ground. As this lumbering weapon system circles a battlefield, the stream of lead is played back and forth like a murderous garden hose. All exposed living creatures die. A more sophisticated version operates from the C-130, but at $15 million, its cost was prohibitive for the IA feature program. The C-47 gunship cost about $200,000, well within our budget at that time. There was no doubt whatever that in August, September, and October 1975, a pair of these gunships would have completely broken the MPLA. But in August, Carl's suggestion was rejected by Potts and the CIA director, who were still working under the original 40 Committee charter, which did not encourage the CIA to seek ways of winning. Bantam had another scheme for easy victory. Called IA Salacious, it was a plan to recruit a few key Portuguese commanders in Luanda and pay them, perhaps $1 million, to execute a coup d'etat using selected Portuguese troops. These Portuguese would then issue a unilateral declaration of independence and hold the MPLA at bay until relieved by Roberto's forces. Presto, an FNLA victory. The file, assembled on an eyes-only basis, contained all the information the agency had on Portuguese commanders in Angola and a plan to dispatch an agent to Luanda to find one to engineer the coup. Under other circumstances, with aggressive case officering and luck, IA Salacious might have worked. Certainly the agency has engineered similar coups. But IA Salacious's first flaw was that the agency wasn't entrenched in Luanda. When successful, such coups are generally engineered by agency operatives who have been in the country for long periods and have developed an infrastructure of good contacts in the military establishment. Its second weakness was that not enough CIA personnel, including the Luanda chief of station, believed in it. Such a coup would put Portuguese troops in armed confrontation with the MPLA armies, whites fighting blacks, touching the fuse of racial violence. IA Salacious never got off the ground. The propaganda of the Angola Civil War was to be as important as the fighting. For that effort, Bubba Sanders was chosen, a senior GS-15, a short, cherubic, and energetic officer whose mission in life was to apply his irrepressible mind toward the harassment of the Soviets throughout Africa. Unfortunately, Bubba, while a fountain of schemes and plots, was not blessed with infallible judgment. His presence on the task force would be a mixed blessing, I thought, remembering a mailing other CIA propagandists had made to Burundi while I was there in 1970. As COS, I had had approval of that operation, and I gave it when I received the proposal from headquarters for a propaganda mailing designed to embarrass the Soviets. I assumed the mailing would be subtle, and that I would see the suggested format before anything was posted. But neither I nor any other knowledgeable operations officer saw anything until posters began appearing in people's mailboxes in the capital, Bujumbura. They were about 12 by 18 inches, printed in stark black and red, portraying a sharp military boot heel crushing hundreds of small figures. Across the top in bold French was printed, "Abba Micombero Dictateur," down with Micombero Dictator. Written across the bottom, as sponsor of the poster, was the cachet of a World Youth Congress, well known to be supported by the Soviets. The mailing worked so well that the Soviet ambassador was subsequently asked not to return from home leave in the Soviet Union. But there was a large hitch. The propagandists had correctly sensed that Micombero ran a bitterly unpopular minority government. What they had missed, or chosen to ignore, was that the schism between Micombero and the masses was purely racial. Micombero and his government were elite Watusi, sensitive to the threat of the suppressed Hutu masses and terrified of the possibility of a Hutu uprising. The Watusi could only interpret the poster as encouragement for Hutu activists who were known to be seeking support for a revolution. Periodically, the Watusi were accustomed to take preemptive measures by killing a lot of Hutus. And lo, 2 years later in 1972, in a paroxysm of genocide that ranked with modern history's most brutal, the Watusi did kill dozens of thousands of Hutus, while the United States and the rest of the world turned its back. How much of a role our ill-advised mailing played in the matter is open to conjecture. Now, 3 years after the massacre, I found Bubba in the covert action branch, already working hard on propaganda ploys to publicize the Soviet support of the MPLA in Angola. The Russians seemed to him delightfully vulnerable as they dumped arms into the civil war. He was scheduled to leave shortly for Rome, Kinshasa, and Lusaka, where he would get the propaganda machine in gear. "The key is a fourth force in Angola," he told me in his office in the covert action branch in D Corridor. "We need to organize a fourth liberation front, which can call for a coalition of all the forces and denounce the Soviet arms shipments." "Where will we get people for this front?" "Angolan exiles, stranded students. There are some right here in the States. We'll call them the Angolan People's Front." "Bubba, if you use Angolans who have been studying here in America, everyone will know it's our front. They won't be listened to by anyone but our friends." "Well, we'll find some in Europe. They won't know the United States is involved. They'll think they're being funded by rich Portuguese refugees. We'll get Angolans who really believe in a peaceful solution, and they can operate maybe from Spain or Brazil. Can you get me the names of some Portuguese who would help?" I promised to query the Lisbon station and the Portuguese task force. "No matter," he said. "We can use Rodriguez or Jimmy Manis. They're sitting out in McLean with nothing to do. Also, there's Brian Cassidy up in New York. He was outstanding when we were working on the Kurds in Iraq. And we'll have to get Ray Childs from Rome, at least for a couple of months. He is beautiful at this sort of thing." Rodriguez, Manis, and Cassidy were writers who supplemented their incomes by doing part-time contract work for the CIA. Ray Childs was a GS-14 staffer with experience in covert action projects. All for the Fourth Force? No, no! We've got to get the FNLA talking to the press in Kinshasa, and UNITA working with the newspaper in Lusaka. We've got reporters in our pockets in both these places, and Mobutu and Kaunda aren't likely to complain when we plant articles in their newspapers. Then we can take articles from those newspapers and have our agents in Europe pick them up and put them in the world press. We'll need officers in Kinshasa, Lusaka, London, Portugal, New York. He leaned back and smiled. This is one psych operation I'm going to enjoy. We'll call it IA Phoenix. You know, the bird that keeps burning itself and rising up from the ashes, like the FNLA coming back from its defeats. IA Phoenix, I like that. I stared at him in disbelief. Phoenix had been the cryptonym for the agency's terrorist program in Vietnam. Even the agency claimed Phoenix had killed over 20,000 people. The Vietnamese government claimed twice as many. Colby himself had designed and managed this program before he became director. During the spring of 1975, he had tried to explain it to Congress, and the press had worked it over. Bubba seemed not to have heard of the Phoenix program. He looked momentarily confused, then brightened. "Well, we'll call it IA Cadence," he said, as I left. On Saturday afternoon, August 2nd, Carl Bantam called to say they had gotten someone else for the task force. He seemed pleased. "It's Paul Foster," he said. "Foster is really outstanding. A GS-13 and 34 years old, but outstanding. He was on the Laos task force with me and spent 5 years upcountry in Laos. He can really get things done. We tried to get him to run this task force originally, but East Asia Division wouldn't let him go. Nelson backed down, but now he's changed his mind again and we're getting Foster." This was normal internal agency politics. Obviously, Nelson had reversed himself just to make it clear that he wrote the EA Division Chief's fitness report, and not vice versa. Carl regarded me for a moment. "Foster will be a co-chief with you. We'll rotate you back and forth to the field. In fact, you know Kinshasa so well, and he's married. Maybe we'll just transfer you to Kinshasa, and he can run the task force back here. That might work out pretty good. Excuse me." He took a call on his phone while I tried to absorb all this. It is common policy in the agency for senior officers to bring people with them when they transfer from other divisions, and to put them in choice slots. Inevitably, this means that the division's own officers are shunted aside. I had seen it happen often, although this was the first time it had struck me personally. I decided right away that under no circumstances would I work for Foster. If they wanted him to run the task force, I would request another assignment. Given my reservations about the Angola program, I rationalized it would be a relief to be forced out of it. But two chiefs? That was inefficient, impractical, and to my knowledge, unprecedented. I watched Carl talking into the phone and waited to explain my views. But when he hung up, he hurried out of the office and down the hall, mumbling that something had come up. Sunday, I read cable traffic and files until 2 p.m., then went jogging into Great Falls Park to an isolated rock formation which projected over a ravine a few hundred yards from the Potomac River. I wanted to think about the program, perhaps even decide to bow out. The job was shaping up, but the reservations were still there. The agency, it seemed to me, had embarked on a careless, no-win intervention in another third-world morass. The Angola program seemed doomed to fail, and moreover was fraught with liabilities for the United States, the CIA, and for John Stockwell, the task force chief. I remembered what had happened to a friend of mine on the Cuban desk when a technical operation in Havana was wrapped up by the Cuban police. He wound up with a letter in his file, compliments of the Miami station chief, prohibiting any promotions for several years. Since such a letter would haunt him the rest of his career, he opted for early retirement and left the agency. On the other hand, I was afflicted with bureaucratic function lust. Angola Task Force Chief was what I had been prepared for in 15 years of government service. And, I rationalized, I was being offered a unique human experience. Like most of the rest of the world, I had only read other people's accounts of Vietnam and the Bay of Pigs. Except in certain narrow areas, I had been dependent on other people's reporting of what had happened, and as a CIA case officer, I knew well how news gets distorted. I did not know how things got done at the policy level in Washington. I had been upcountry in Vietnam, not involved in headquarters activity. Even during the ouster of Nkrumah in Ghana, I was one country away, in the Ivory Coast. The inside story came to me from an egotistical friend who had been chief of station in Accra at the time. Now it would be different. In the Angola program, I was involved from the outset. I would have access to the inner secrets and the most accurate intelligence about the war. I could evaluate what was being done on the basis of personal experience in Central Africa, which dated back 30 years. After it was over, I could continue my career or resign, confident that I had really known the clandestine services, that I was not quitting just before promotion to a level where I would suddenly understand. Tomorrow I would put Foster in his place and keep working on the organization of the task force. I jogged back along the trail, sprinting up hills in the fading light. At 7:30 Monday morning, I took the IA feature cables from the Horn and Central slot in registry. In an hour, I had read and sorted them into piles according to importance. Those requiring an early answer or discussion in staff meeting, I read a second time, making notes of key cryptonyms, names, figures, and details. At 8:30, I interrupted my reading to catch Potts in his office. It was imperative that I nip the Paul Foster challenge in the bud before Bantam could maneuver me off to Kinshasa and take away my ringside seat in this little war. The key to my counterattack would be Potts's pride. If he felt his authority was being challenged, he would keep Carl in line. I also had the advantage that Carl was suggesting an unorthodox arrangement to favor his protege, Foster. Potts tended to opt for standard solutions to personnel problems. Leaning against his office door, I asked Potts about Foster's position on the task force. Apparently Carl hadn't got to him yet, and Potts quickly assured me that Foster would be the deputy chief. He was looking thoughtful as I left, however, and I knew I had better not slip even half a step in running the task force. My African experience was too strong a temptation if they developed problems in Kinshasa. Then I braced Carl Bantam. When he began to repeat his plan to make us co-chiefs, I quickly interrupted. I reminded him that I had extensive experience in Africa and was senior to Foster. If he and Potts wanted me to run the program, I was interested. Otherwise, I could move on to another assignment. Bantam stood before me, reflecting. Most of his career had been spent as officer in charge. He hadn't recently served as anyone's deputy, and he was realizing for the first time the limitations of his present position. He didn't have the authority to make the final decision. Reluctantly, he acquiesced, I would be the chief and Foster the deputy. Bantam smiled, and we headed out for staff meeting together. Of course, he would keep trying, and I would be under constant pressure from the ambitious Foster, who had a strong supporter in the front office. But I could handle that. Carl and I went into the conference room together, talking about tennis. After staff meeting, I stopped in George Costello's office to drive the last nail into Foster's position. George hadn't settled down to work yet. George, I understand you're bringing a young hotshot in from EA Division to run the task force for us. George was an old Africa hand and would be inclined to resent Foster's intrusion. Well, Potts and Carl are in a little bit of a bind. Apparently they had offered this fellow the job, but there was some mix-up. No problem, I said. It's at a bucket of worms anyway. I don't know how much experience Potts and Carl and the man in Kinshasa have in Africa, or Foster. He makes it a new team. Anyway, he can run the task force, and I'll go back to Texas and do some more fishing. George Costello was a huge man. Standing, he towered over me and jammed a thick finger against my chest. You aren't going anywhere. You are the task force chief. They need you more than they realize. Potts doesn't have any experience in Africa. Carl never set foot on the continent. St. Martin hasn't been in Kinshasa long, and Foster doesn't even know where it is on the map. Now you get your ass out of here and get to work.